I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at your question.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pajaisky, and this episode I talk to forensic jewellery expert Maria McLennan. Maria is a lecturer in jewellery and silversmithing at the Edinburgh College of Art and researches jewellery's role in human identification. She spent 5 years applying this research with Police Scotland and the Scottish Police Authority, and, as you'll hear in this conversation, has advised on criminal cases involving identification through jewellery. So this episode comes with a content warning. My conversation with Maria covers police forensic work involving human remains in both accidental and criminal cases, which some listeners may find disturbing or triggering. So if that's not something that you fancy hearing about right now, then consider giving this episode a miss. I started by asking Maria about her route to becoming a forensic jewellery expert.
In terms of my story, it was a very serendipitous journey to get to where I am now. I trained as a jewellery designer originally, so I come from the kind of design background rather than the forensic or the policing or any kind of scientific background whatsoever. And I think I've always been interested in materials. As you say, somebody who is studying a primarily crafts-based discipline, materials are hugely important. And a lot of us are materials driven and practice led. But for me, I was always more interested behind in the stories behind jewellery and the people that kind of either made it or wore it or kind of came to engage with it somehow. So sitting at a jewellery bench making jewellery was kind of fun, but I also felt a little bit detached from it, and I felt that there was something missing, whereby when other jewellery designers were sitting down at the bench, they talked about this amazing creative process and this affinity that they had with tools and materials. And I thought, oh, there's something wrong with me that I don't feel that way. I don't feel that connection, maybe, with my hand and the tool I'm holding or the material that I'm working with. So I guess in a kind of roundabout way, I knew I loved jewellery, but I didn't really know what else I could do with that degree or with that practice. And I did a bit of a 360 in that I kind of moved away from jewellery and studied design more generally. And I moved into the remit of service design and interdisciplinary design. So I started to think of design as a tool for problem solving and a methodology. And that really led me into working with everybody from kind of the police to embalmers, forensic scientists, and kind of understanding the applications of design beyond the discipline of design itself. And I say I did a 360 in that it was only really by kind of moving into these fields such as policing, crime and forensic science, I fell in love all over again with my own discipline, because I understood the value of, you know, not just in a financial or monetary sense, I understood the value of jewellery or gemstones or diamonds or silver in fields such as criminology and forensic science. And I kind of then had a newfound appreciation for the discipline and everyone within it, because I started to understand jewelers and gemologists and valuers as investigators and as detectives. Mm. So I kind of maybe came to that realization quite late, because I think a lot of the jewelry discipline already prides itself on its detective work. Appraisers or gemologists, for example, they sit with their microscopes, they view these amazing, tiny, detailed galaxies of information. And I didn't really think of jewellery like that until actually I'd experienced working in quite a far-reaching discipline like forensic science. Mm. So yeah, the advice I have in terms of how other people would get into the field, I think a lot of jewellers are already forensically minded. They're already doing a lot of detective and forensic work. So I guess the question is more about how we bring together these quite disparate fields, actually, and create more of a foundation for which these two disciplines can come together and work more closely in the future.
Yeah. So what does the work of a forensic jewellery expert involve? You know, how can you use jewellery as a forensic tool?
I think one of the things that makes jewellery so fascinating in a forensic context is its kind of its associations with identity, death and the human body, which I guess are the three tenets that I'm sort of really interested in. It's not actually a new or an innovative application for jewellery. It's actually one of the oldest practices that we have, is to kind of use decoration and adornment of the body in some way to kind of communicate our identity. You know, even kind of back in the caveman days, you know, we were sort of fashioning jewellery out of teeth and shells and the material that we had around us. And the thing I find fascinating, I'm not an archaeologist, I would love to be, but is the kind of the social value of jewellery. You know, even in those kind of really primitive days, we weren't kind of really keeping ourselves warm or feeding one another or providing shelter through jewellery. It was that additional social value. So whether it was a status or symbol of power, whether it was to denote some kind of belonging to a tribe, or, you know, there was always that additional layer of meaning that denoted something about the individuals who made it or wore it or gifted it. And I think the same is true to this day, where if we found hypothetically a piece of jewellery on a body, an unidentified set of human remains, we can identify in most cases the maker of the piece of jewellery and understand therefore potentially who it was made for, where it was made, why it was made. And we can kind of begin that process of tracing that piece of jewellery back through the maker or the manufacturer or the designer, potentially to the owner or the wearer. So it's not always the most scientific or reliable or consistent approach, but in theory and in practice on a number of occasions, it's highly possible to use jewellery in that manner. So I guess the practice of a forensic jeweller is kind of using the principles and tools and techniques that underpin jewellery. And jewellery identification in general within that criminal or forensic setting.
It's such an interesting mixture, isn't it, of disciplines. What materials properties do you sort of look for or value, I suppose, in these materials? Well, firstly, what are the materials, I suppose? But then, you know, how do their materials properties help you do this?
I think, yeah, it's a really interesting question because I don't suppose I ever really think of myself as being, I've never really thought of myself as being someone who's all that materials driven.
Mm.
And, you know, even when I talked earlier about kind of sitting down at the bench and having different materials or tools in front of me and feeling a bit of a disconnect with, you know, the ideas maybe I had in my mind and how I wanted to kind of realise those in practice, right through to now, I guess I think of my work as being, the materials get me from A to B sometimes, you know, so by identifying the materials, be it a particular kind of golds that I can age or date or, you know, locate to a particular era of time or place or geographic kind of region. I'm not a gemologist, but in theory, you know, you can use the same principles for determining where a diamond or a gemstone came from, or being able to kind of identify the engraving or the serial number on a diamond or on a watch. You can kind of retrace the steps or the journey that that piece has been on. So for me, the materials are kind of clues, and I can kind of reconstruct, I guess, a potential or a hypothetical context or series of events or scenarios by looking for the kind of clues that the materials provide, whether that's the age of the material or the way that the material was constructed, or even the kind of user personalization, if the individual themselves has kind of adapted that material in some way. I'm always quite interested in how we personalize our own, so even if it's not a professional repair job, for example, we are always kind of altering and fiddling and fidgeting with our own pieces of jewelry or our clothing or our own personal effects in a way that sets us apart from our neighbors or our peers. So for me, materials are clues, just as any crime scene, I guess, leaves a clue or a trace. It's just about how you identify and then how you reconstruct using your own knowledge of those materials and how they were brought into fruition to kind of lead you down a particular avenue of investigation.
Sure. And I guess as well, you know, not to get too gruesome about it, but these are very long-lasting materials, metals, gemstones, very hard. There could be instances where maybe these materials are some of the only clues that you've got in terms of, you know, where the person was found, what had happened to them, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there is a really cruel irony in a lot of the phrases, like diamonds are forever, and, you know, they really do, like the materials that jewellery, I guess, more traditionally is made from, they do have that physical, you know, it's very robust. It can, as you say, withstand a lot of trauma, a lot of exposure to the elements. And it sadly does often outlive its human host. So where we have things like metals and gemstones, they survive far better than kind of textiles and other materials that are prone to disintegration. They do survive the test of time as well, whether that's kind of, you know, through sort of archaeological contexts or whether it's through you know, increasing impact and trauma from a series of events, building collapses, plane crashes. Yeah, they can withstand and resist a lot of trauma and impact. But I guess that's coupled with the fact that we are no longer always relying on those materials for jewellery. You know, increasingly we're moving into the realm of mass manufacture, and we're using kind of plastics and paper, and we're experimenting with innovative manufacturing techniques too. So there are kind of pros and cons, I guess, to the materials we use, and certainly in a forensic setting, what that means in terms of identification.
Yeah, that's interesting, because like what you were saying earlier about, you know, potentially serial numbers, or if you have maybe certain kind of fingerprints of jewellers that are really distinct, you know, and well known, then it's easier to sort of trace them back. Whereas if it's pieces that are mass produced or kind of widely worn, then that's going to be less of a useful lead, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, there's always ways in which, you know, it's very circumstantial and context specific, but there are still ways that cheaper mass produced items can be really useful and can provide that that vital piece of evidence or clue in an investigation. So even where something doesn't possess a serial number or isn't of a particularly high financial value, you know, we do see it's possible to lift DNA, for example, off surfaces that are, you know, not just metal, not just diamonds. Equally, as I mentioned, user personalization, you know, if there's a particular sentimental value to something, if an individual is constantly kind of wearing or holding or using or carrying with them on a daily basis, a piece, you know, it can even be recognizable from members of the public, family, friends, Facebook photographs. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which social media is kind of providing a crucial identification element. So materials don't have to necessarily be physical, they could be digital. And there are other ways in which these cheaper and mass produced items can still be differentiated, can still be personalized, and can still be kind of traced back to the individual.
Are you able to share any sort of stories from your work?
There's definitely things that have stuck with me where I remember one of the questions I got asked, certainly when I first got into this area, I got asked quite a lot at the beginning, was how somebody with my training and experience copes with the kind of working in a mortuary or visiting a crash site, or, you know, even just looking at images, not necessarily being up all that close and personal, but even just talking about these types of theme. I don't really have the formal training, and how did I handle it? How do I handle it? And I think the thing that still to this day always jumps out at me and sticks in my mind is that for me, seeing things like jewelry and experiencing and kind of having that connection, maybe it is because of my background, but I find those more upsetting sometimes and triggering, I guess, because balled up in that tiny little piece of jewelry is a whole life and story and set of experiences, relationships of that individual. And there's something about witnessing a really personal piece of jewellery in that kind of context that is really probably more disturbing and more upsetting than seeing and being presented with a body. You know, and I think maybe there's a sense of being desensitized to that kind of imagery that comes from seeing it in Hollywood dramatizations and crime scene television shows. But the thing that always strikes me is in a mass fatality context in particular, seeing, you know, just rows and rows sometimes of personal effects, jewellery, images from people's kind of wallets or purses, their handwriting, all of these personal objects they own is not just exclusive to jewellery. That's a real kind of keyhole into their lives. It's a really private and really personal thing. And I'll never forget the first kind of time I saw all of these items co-mingled together. You know, and you just get a sense of how all of these individuals' lives were very sadly and very cruelly also kind of commingled into this sort of collective identity. So that's, you know, that can be sad. But when you are able to then almost try to separate out and look for the meaning and search amongst the debris, you know, for actually quite literally the diamond in the rough sometimes. But also the proverbial, and that's what you're looking for. You're looking for that little glimmer of hope, but also that one tiny clue that you could use to potentially identify an individual based on all of these disparate pieces of information. It's difficult, but when you are able to find that little clue, that could be the thing that then unravels a whole host of other avenues of investigation that are more scientific. So then you can start looking for things like DNA, fingerprints, dental records, and the more kind of reliable, as it were, means of establishing identity. So yeah, for me, I think it's always going to be quite shocking. I don't think it ever gets easier, but I think when you're able to sort of, you know, find the meaning in that chaos, that's where it's really, really beneficial and powerful work. And you're kind of reminded of the value and the different value of a piece of jewellery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I mean, what I would say is a lot of my research is theoretical. I won't shy away from the fact that it's primarily research, and the cases I have worked on in the past have either been not only ongoing forensic cases, but sometimes ongoing criminal cases. So I am either not allowed to talk, or I try to not talk about the specifics just out of respect for the individuals involved. Yeah, there have been a number of cases where either specific examples of jewellery, specific pieces have stood out, or the contribution that piece has had to the case has been really quite, I've had kind of investigators or police officers ask for my advice in identifying the piece of jewellery, and what they're looking for really is more of a, can you tell us who this belonged to, or can you tell us something about the individual based on the jewellery? And I don't often get a lot of the context. I'm often not allowed a lot of the context. And I always have to try and reiterate that the context is everything. And in isolation, I could identify the piece of jewellery and tell you something about that. But there's so much more to jewellery's contribution in a case than just identifying the piece. So where that piece was located in a crime scene, that can speak volumes about who last interacted with it, or how and where it was positioned could provide a really crucial clue. And that could be the difference between a death being accidental or deliberate. It could be the difference between a crime scene being staged somehow, or, you know, being more of a kind of natural or accidental.
Yeah.
So I often find that the lack of understanding that the police and other investigators currently have about the value of something and the importance of the contribution of jewellery, I miss a lot of the context because they just don't think that's actually that important,
right?
Which is a shame. And I think that's where there's a lot of the theoretical applications for my research still haven't been quite translated into practice yet.
Mm. So what are your current research questions? What are you trying to answer?
I've become really interested more recently in, I'm increasingly interested in gemology, which I'm not a professional gemologist, but I've just started to take further courses in that because I think forensic gemology, I guess, is a discipline that has been referred to in the past, but I think mostly that's about kind of, I don't think that's forensic in the same way that I use the word, and they talk more about kind of litigation or insurance or jewellery and gem theft and trafficking and whether or not stones have been switched out or so the area of jewellery and gem theft is really interesting because it's one of the fastest growing crimes internationally that can be seen as a bridge into other areas such as terrorism and kind of drug smuggling. So that's quite interesting, but I think there are other applications for gemological techniques in the same way that jewellery techniques have been applied to the area of forensic human identification. And there have already been a number of cases where the Gemological Institute of America, who are the kind of national body for diamonds and gems in the US, they work with the police on a number of cases whereby they've been able to track and trace diamonds that have been involved in crimes that have been recovered in homicide investigations, for example. So I'm becoming increasingly interested in that kind of area, but in terms of research questions, haven't really fully formed one in that respect yet.
Yeah.
But I'm also quite interested in, I mean, we talked earlier about how new technologies or materials or mass manufacturing might creep in and actually be a bit of an issue or a bit of a problem. But actually, I think there's a whole host of opportunities whereby contemporary jewellery and art jewellery, you know, I'm interested in the future archaeological potential of those pieces. So the kind of work that contemporary designers are putting out into the world, what are the consequences and implications for our kind of future ancestors in digging up those sorts of artefacts? And if they were trying to look at kind of the material culture or the forensic jewellery that we leave behind, I guess I'm really interested in the problems or the potential implications for future wear, use and identity that both the materials we're using, but also the, I guess, the purpose and the reason that we're currently putting work out into the world isn't just for a particular purpose anymore. It's experimental, it's abstract, it's probably going to cause a lot of confusion for some of the future generations.
Yeah, and what will all of that say about us as a society in 2021?
exactly. And I think the wider, I guess, research question, I suppose, that captures all of that is I'm really interested in, I guess, jewellery as different forms of data. You know, we've understood it as archaeological, anthropological, material culture. We're now understanding it as potentially forensic evidence or criminal evidence. But I think with the increase in digital wearables, Fitbits, and kind of, you know, increasingly miniaturized technologies that are being introduced in relation to the body, primarily sometimes using jewellery as a way in which to kind of sight those around the body, I mean, those are kind of pulling data from our body through our biometrics. You know, there's a way that our jewellery is now kind of being used as a means to capture and store and harness data. So I think that idea of jewellery as data in both a kind of qualitative and quantitative, historical, contemporary and future sense, I think is a really interesting space. So from a forensic perspective, I think there's a lot of potential to explore that further as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. I often ask makers this or experts this, and I've had a range of responses. So I'm not sure how you feel about this, but what's the most sort of surprising thing that you've learned?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think actually when I first sort of became involved in the area, I remember I'm a big fan of kind of juxtapositions and contrasts. And I think for me, it was quite cool thinking, oh, forensics and jewellery, that's kind of, it's that sort of CSI sexy science in a way, isn't it? It's something that, and I don't mean that in any sort of sense, like any disrespectful sense whatsoever, but you know, we are fascinated by true crime and forensics, and people are really interested in kind of new technologies and how, you know, these kind of disciplines that traditionally aren't associated with one another could come together. And I guess that kind of fascinated me, and I thought, wow, we've really been missing a trick here. These disciplines could kind of share knowledge, and there's a whole new field that could emerge as a result. And the more I get involved in it, the more I explore it, the more I work with experts in both the fields of forensics and jewellery, I guess the thing that I found most surprising is how similar they both are. And actually, they're not that polarized, they're not that different. There is an element of art in forensics. There's an element of creativity and imagination and piecing together those jigsaw puzzles. That is, you know, there's an element of being able to think outside the box a little bit and kind of imagine these potential scenarios or these plausible scenarios. And there's maybe a little bit more subjectivity in forensics than I thought. And on the flip side of that coin, there's a whole host of detective work involved in jewellery design, in jewellery valuation, appraisal, identification. And actually, a lot of it is quite objective. You know, there is a science to it. There is a really scientific, methodical objectivity. So there's a lovely kind of sense of the two disciplines actually being quite similar, and yet there's still room for each one to kind of learn from one another and grow from one another and share knowledge. So, yeah, it probably surprised me the most to learn, actually. They're quite similar. And then it made me think, I guess, how many other disciplines are out there that could come together and actually already have parallels. And it always got me thinking, like, you know, we have forensic textile science, for example, fibre evidence. And what would happen if a textile designer actually came along and started to sort of investigate that with their designerly mind? So that kind of thing really interested me, and I'm fascinated by forensic art and how they use the principles that underpin art and sculpture and drawing and things like that, and apply that in a forensic context. So it made me think more about, well, then what would forensic design be, and how could other disciplines of design, graphic design, architectural design, interior design, a lot of those principles are already used in kind of criminal and forensic contexts. But what would happen if a designer applied their way of thinking to that kind of setting?
It's exactly what I'm trying to do with this podcast, is through the lens of materials, kind of demonstrate that there are all these different perspectives that we can take, you know, from one end of the spectrum, very scientific, where I've trained, all the way to the other side, you know, artists and craftspeople and designers, like you say, all looking at the same stuff and thinking about it in a different way. But actually, the overlaps are huge. And it's interesting what you were saying about the ways of thinking sometimes actually being quite similar, but just having sort of a different context, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, there's so many obvious connections that I've come to learn. And sometimes I sort of, I'll stumble across something and I'll think, oh, wow, I wonder, does anyone already know that? And yeah. I'm not sure if it's something I have stumbled across or if it's something that either discipline has already been doing for a number of years. And I guess that's the nature of research in general. But it's interesting because I think although each discipline is kind of doing its own thing, in respect of, say, let's use forensic textile science again as an example, you know, I'm in touch with a couple of really wonderful makers who are moving into the field of fashion forensics. So individuals who are fashion historians or clothing designers, and, you know, they're all approaching it from slightly different perspectives. But there are a number of academic projects in America as well that are kind of looking at the forensic history of clothing and the criminal kind of implications of clothing. So again, is it something that the fields of forensics and criminology have already looked at? Well, yes, in a way, but they won't have done it in the same way. New insight will be gathered and gleaned from these new perspectives, as you're saying. So I think you can revisit the same topic 100 times over, but it's the perspective that you bring that will always provide that fresh and that new insight. And I think that's where, even with a long-standing forensic discipline that we think we really know, you know, lots and lots about, I think get somebody with a brand new perspective and take on it, and you will absolutely learn something that you didn't already know.
Definitely. So if people have been interested to hear from you and about this field, is there anywhere that they can go to kind of find out more about it or to look you up and see what you're up to?
Yeah, I think so I need a website and I don't have one yet. Okay. So hopefully there will be one soon, but I think the best and probably most informal way is maybe to catch me on Instagram, and I'm always happy to receive a little message on Instagram, and we can then take it into emailing or take it into the more appropriate mode of communication from there. So my Instagram handle is just @forensicjewellery, spelt in the kind of British English sense of the word. So yeah, I'm more than happy to be contacted there.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for chatting to me. This is a field that I knew absolutely nothing about. I didn't even know it existed before we got introduced. So I've learned a lot today.
You're not the only one. It's a field I knew nothing about. And still every day I wonder how I found myself here. And yeah, as I say, I think for anyone interested in getting involved, there really is no formal route. So yeah, I'm happy to chat to anyone, and thank you so much for having me. It's been really wonderful to chat to you too, a real pleasure.
So that was the incredible Maria McLennan on forensic jewellery. A huge thank you to her for coming on the show and for sharing her unique expertise with us on the podcast. That's everything for this week. As always, it would be awesome if you could like and subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcasting app to keep up to date with everything that is going on at Handmade HQ. If you want to say hi to us on social media, you can do so on Twitter at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. If you feel like supporting the podcast with a one-time financial donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Huge thanks to everyone who has already done so. Thanks too to Dave Shepherd for our awesome cover art and to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next week, I'll be talking to embroiderer Julia Lodigrina. So until then, take very good care, and I'll speak to you next time on Handmade.